I'm going to have to do a pickup. I'm sorry. Because I have to look this up.
This is a disgrace. What did I say again?
3, 2.
It's embarrassing, Neil, that you didn't have that stat ready.
1.
You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm not.
Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart, made up to try to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is as a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bone. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown 538 Sports Podcast. I'm Chad Gmatlin, editor at 538. With me in the studio all together today, first to my right, Statman Neil Payne, 538 Sports Writer. Hello, Neil.
Hey, Chad, what's up?
Hello, hello. And our associate liaison between 538 and ESPNW, it's Kate Fagan.
Thanks,
hello, Kate.
Chad. Hi, thank you for my new fancy title.
You earned it, Kate.
Liaison?
Yeah, you're the liaison.
Okay, cool. Well,
Kate, it's early yet.
Okay, so I have promotions to come.
Absolutely.
Yeah, this okay, seems cool. Like an entry-level position.
I know.
Yeah.
Sometimes we bring people on for the first time, and they're like the global correspondent.
Yeah.
And I'm like a liaison.
You're the liaison.
Kate, we got a lot of podcasts left in us, all right?
Okay.
You've only been on the podcast for a year and a half. A lot of room to grow.
It's a long game.
Okay, cool.
On today's show, Bill Barnwell is here to talk about coaching decisions and many other things in the first week of the NFL. What else? What else? Baseball. The teams are barreling down the home stretch. We will check in on tight races in the AL East and NL wildcard warning, trigger warning, and the Mets will be mentioned. And then finally, we will wrap our U.S. Open coverage with 538's associate tennis liaison, Carl Bialik, who will tell us why 538 was so bad at predicting who would win. And then for our significant digit, Tim Tebow returns to Hot Takedown. Outside of the opening theme.
Are we teasing a Tim Tebow segment later on in this show?
That's a sig dig. Neil has made the rant last week.
So we are also jumping on the Tebow as entertainment bandwagon.
We are running the stats about whether he is entertainment, pure total entertainment.
Wow, so that actually dovetails.
The entertainment quotient.
Or okay. Actual, you know, has a chance in the majors.
We put
the numbers to the test.
He doesn't, Chad.
Neil,
don't
save
give
it
away.
For sig dig. People are going to turn off the podcast.
We've teased Tebow. They're going to stick around for that if you don't give away the information before Tebow.
This is basics of entertainment.
This is when we,
a real cliffhanger.
We get all of our the vegetables in because we save the dessert for the end.
Oh, God, Neil, we may have to pull you from sig dig.
I know.
All right, on to the show proper. We are joined by ESPN's Bill Barnwell of the Bill Barnwell Show. Hello, Bill.
Hey, everyone.
So, Bill, I want to talk a bit about coaching and week one in the NFL. Let's start, I think, with Jack Del Rio and the Oakland Raiders, who had what to the more conservative NFL fan looked like an unorthodox decision to go for two down by 1 point after scoring a touchdown with 47 seconds remaining in their game against the Saints. They went for two. They got the two-point conversion. Here is what Adam Schein from the Mad Dog Sports Radio had to say about that decision.
Jack Del Rio. Yes. I, in a million years, if I'm coaching the Raiders, I would not have decided to go for two. Wild game, and Jack Del Rio, extra point to tie it at 34? Hell no. Hell no. You think he's going to kick the extra point? Hell no. Moxie, toughness, guts, Jack Del Rio. How about the call of the fade to Crabtree for the two-point conversion? Are you kidding me?
Wow, there wasn't a lot of concrete analysis happening there.
But I did get an idea for my tombstone. Moxie.
That is an underused word, not necessarily praising it in this capacity.
I like gumption also.
Gumption is also a fantastic word.
So, Neil and Bill, I think both of you have written, whether it be on ESPN-affiliated websites or social media, about this two-point conversion call.
Who wasn't writing about this?
And, Kate, I have a feeling you probably have been speaking about it on ESPN-affiliated networks.
And I saw Jack Del Rio's burn tweet.
about ESPN Stats and Info. Yeah, so we should say...
Sick bird.
So Neil, maybe you could introduce the ESPN Stats and Info tweet and saying that he shouldn't have gone for it, and then also what the...
Yeah.
What Del Rio said and what the stats actually show.
Yeah, sure. So Stats and Info, ESPN's kind of stat head wing of researchers and programmers and modelers and stuff, have this win probability model that was created by Brian Burke. And it's, I think, one of the better win probability models out there. But it said that basically if you were in Jack Del Rio's shoes after scoring that touchdown and you had the choice of take the one-pointer and go into a likely overtime or take the two-pointer, risk it, but if you get it, then you probably win, that they would have been better off kicking the extra point and playing for overtime instead of taking the two and kind of putting it on everything then and there, which I thought was pretty surprising, because the I would have thought the conventional statistical wisdom, first of all, is teams don't go for two enough, and that it's kind of an underused thing. And then also that, you know, this idea of your last best chance to win is in the moment. And we always complain about coaches being too conservative and that they're playing not to lose and they're playing to extend the game. And that's like a very common stat head complaint about NFL coaches. And Jack Del Rio, in this case, did the opposite of that, and then he got criticized by the stats, and but he had the last laugh, because he had the tweet where he responded to Stats and Info, who had said this equation of, you know, being more likely to win if he had just kicked the extra point, by saying, good thing ESPN isn't coaching the Raiders. And I think it's up to 50,000 likes right now. So it was a pretty good comeback by Coach Del Rio.
He had a good weekend.
Yeah, he had a good weekend.
I think there's an issue with that Stats and Info that data, and I think they would say as much if you read the article that was attached to that tweet, which is that those numbers are not adjusted for the opposition. And in this case, the opposition is very important when it comes to analyzing this question, because the Saints have one of the best offenses in all of football. And in fact, it's fair to say not only the worst defense in all of football, if you look at last season and how they played in week one, but one of the worst defenses in recent league history. And defense that was even worse when you counter with the fact that Delvin Bro, who's their best cornerback and maybe even their best defender, was out with what ended up going down as a broken fibula, and he's out for 6 weeks. So this was a those numbers not being adjusted for opponent. In a vacuum, I think that those would make sense. But given that the Saints are so bad or so distinct when it comes to their strengths and weaknesses, I think the numbers are far less likely to be what Stats and Info gave than perhaps what was actually on the field at the time. You know, the Saints are not a team that's 16th in offense and 17th on defense. They're maybe a top five offense and the 32nd ranked defense in football.
So they're literally the worst team to be facing in that situation when you're kind of giving the ball back to them after the two-point conversion.
Right. Sean Payton's someone who's been very aggressive in these sort of situations in the past, so they're more likely perhaps to try and score with 45 seconds left, and I think they maybe had one timeout, if I'm not mistaken. And their defense is uniquely terrible. And so I think very much so they're the optimal team in this situation where you'd want to go for two against them to win this kind of game.
So this is where I think sometimes the Yak Fest on TV does take into account some things that data can often ignore if you're not careful, in the sense that I think commentators would be able to tell you that the Saints were shredding the Raiders,
like,
all day.
Don't give the ball back to Drew.
Exactly.
Brees.
And so, like, this is where I think, you know, we usually take down takes for being not data-based enough. But maybe here, this is where the take, in some ways, is sort of embedded in the data, because the data isn't, or the models aren't as complex as they need to be.
Yeah, and they don't seem quite as, like, timely as they need to be, and flexible as in taking into account the Saints in that moment. And it's more like a little static from, like, older data.
Mm-hmm. And I think there's always, whenever I talk about this kind of stuff, I always listen to coaches, and coaches always say, well, you know, the numbers say this, but we got to account for what's happening on the field. And it's very true, and you do need to account for what happens on the field, but almost always that is a crutch for crutches to be more conservative than the numbers suggest. It's always, you know, well, the numbers said go for it, but our right guard was getting destroyed, or we didn't have a good play call, or I just didn't feel like we were emotionally ready. It's always a crutch to be conservative, and this is one of the rare cases, maybe the first I can think of, where a coach was more aggressive than the numbers might have slightly suggested. So I think... you know, I think I give credit for Del Rio just for sort of at least thinking out of the box, even if the numbers say that it might have been necessarily the right or wrong call. I think, to be honest, the numbers are close enough that I think it's within the margin of error either way.
So let's continue our NFL omnibus by going up to New England, where Jimmy Garoppolo had a very good debut, I think it would be fair to say. 72% completion, 264 yards, one touchdown, leading the Patriots to victory. And it seemed like a lot of the credit after the game, and Bill, I think you wrote this on ESPN, was owed to Bill Belichick and his coaching staff for figuring out which Cardinals secondary players to target for Garoppolo. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, there's a really glaring one in that you have a Pro Bowl cornerback on one side of the field, bringing up that debate again, in Patrick Peterson. They have Tyrann Mathieu, who's a very good cornerback, who was playing safety last week, playing free safety, basically because I think he's not 100% and coming back from his torn ACL. And the guy on the other side of the field was Brandon Williams, who is a converted running back and a rookie who playing cornerback for 1 year. And you might suspect there's a target on him, and indeed the Patriots did a great job of exploiting him. That's something that they've done in years past. They really love to target the weakest link in a secondary. The classic example is the, I guess, that playoff run where they played the Ravens and the Seahawks, and they came back against the Ravens playing, beating Rashawn Melvin, who was a street free agent the Ravens brought in like week 14 to start, and then avoided Richard Sherman altogether during the Super Bowl that year. So they really, whether it's Brady, whether it's Garoppolo, whether it's Gronkowski, whether it's Edelman, whether it's any of the personnel, they love going after the weakest part of an opposing defense, and are very good at sort of identifying it and exploiting it.
So it sounds like you would kind of offer more credit to the coaching staff than maybe Garoppolo himself or anything, even though he did have that 106 quarterback rating, the 8 yards per attempt and so on.
Well, I mean, the classic example is that first touchdown where, Garoppolo makes a totally fine throw. There's nothing wrong with the throw in the slightest to Chris Hogan, but it's a totally blown coverage. I mean, it really is just a function of, the Patriots confused Williams and had him in what he thought was a shallow zone coverage when he was supposed to be in man. It's pitch and catch. I mean, a high school quarterback could have made that throw. And it's not to say Garoppolo stunk or that, that he doesn't deserve any credit, but I mean, that's like, in terms of the amount of effort and amount of ability needed to score that touchdown pass, like, that was 2% Garoppolo and 98%, external factors. Whereas, there are certain plays that Garoppolo or Brady might have made that are, much more so credited towards the quarterback.
Okay, so here's my Garoppolo thought experiment, or kind of crazy hypothetical. What it sounds like you're saying now is that Garoppolo did fine. He did great. He did what was asked of him, but not necessarily anything to kind of make Tom Brady nervous when he comes back. My question is, how well would Jimmy Garoppolo have to play in order for Belichick to seriously think back to 2001 and think about Drew Bledsoe and think about Tom Brady and kind of think about the inverse happening to Brady? Is there a 0% chance of that happening no matter what Garoppolo does, or would he have to lead the league in passing through 4 weeks? What would his numbers have to look like in order for that kernel of a thought to even enter Belichick's head?
This is the most irrational question I think I've ever heard Neil.
But it's a statistical question in some sense.
I don't think it's quite as irrational. I mean, having lived in Boston for most of the last 15 years, I mean, I heard, people over the last 5 or 6 years saying, hey, especially after that Chiefs game, it was, oh, Brady has to go. Like, his time's up. And I think it's more a function of what Brady does when he gets back, perhaps, than what Garoppolo does. I think Garoppolo has to play extremely well, of course. It's the first part of it. But I think if Brady comes back and he, has a couple games where he throws an interception or two, he just doesn't look like the same guy, I think that's when the Garoppolo heat would come on. So I think he has to play as one of the better quarterbacks in football, if not the best. But it's more that Brady has to play extremely poorly.
So, Bill, before we let you go, what couple quick fire things.
Sure.
One, does Garoppolo's success mean that Brady isn't that good because it's Belichick who's actually that
total
good?
Fraud.
Okay,
total
good.
Fraud.
Good.
We've always known that, though. I mean, is this proving this, really, though?
Right. I mean, like one informs the other. I think, I don't think there's anything wrong with saying that Brady has gotten help from playing in a good scheme, but he also has helped, the stuff he does in that scheme is more than I think a lot of other quarterbacks would be able to do. Every quarterback has a good scheme.
All right, Bill Barnwell of the Bill Barnwell Show. Bill, we didn't even get a chance to talk about RG3's sad end to his barely existing.
Did we need to talk about that, Chad, though?
Joe Sykes, our producer, was really invested in that redemption narrative, and he was slacking me mid-show, trying to get me to bring RG3 back in, but there just was no time for Robert Griffin III, just as there was no place for him in the NFL.
This is real sad.
Harsh.
Hot take.
It's bleak.
All right, Bill Barnwell. Listeners, you can go subscribe to Bill Barnwell's show, The Bill Barnwell Show. if you want more of this trenchant NFL commentary and every now and then a Bachelor podcast.
And he's got Moxie.
And he's got Moxie.
And Gumption.
And Gumption.
Yeah.
All right, Bill. Thanks so much.
Thanks, guys.
Before we move on to baseball, let's dwell in football for just one more second with a word from one of Hot Takedown's sponsors this week, DraftKings. Football is back, and to celebrate, DraftKings is hosting another free fantasy contest this weekend. $100,000 in total prizes are up for grabs. No deposit is required from you. You heard that right. $0 deposit. So put your fantasy knowledge to the test for free to win your share of $100,000 this weekend at DraftKings.com. DraftKings is the destination for one-week fantasy football. That means no season-long commitments. Play when you want, with the players you want, against who you want. Just pick your contest, draft your players, and follow your team live. Whether you're a one-week fantasy rookie or a grizzled vet, DraftKings offers contests for you all season long. So, hurry to DraftKings.com now. Use code TAKEDOWN and play free this weekend in the $100,000 fantasy contest. Again, that is a free contest. No deposit required. The promo code to get into that contest is TAKEDOWN. You can play for free for your share of $100,000 only at DraftKings.com. Eligibility restrictions may apply. See the website DraftKings.com for details. Okay, now on to baseball, which I feel like we haven't really talked about in a while. I never feel like we talk about baseball enough, it's but that true. Might be.
But you guys do an
bias.
Entire podcast on it.
That
you just
that,
feel like in this collection,
right?
Of
yeah, that's supposed okay. to be completely separate, got different, it. Parallel
and,
tracks.
You weren't there, and so without
so
you,
it's subpar. It,
yeah,
it's inferior.
Exactly.
I see.
So I want to talk about two races as we come down the stretch with about two and a half, three weeks left in the season. We have the AL East, which is historically close, as Ben Lindbergh, our old colleague, wrote today on The Ringer, the what was once Grantland but now is reborn. The Red Sox are in first place in the AL East. They are up two games on the Blue Jays, three on the Orioles, and five on the Yankees, and all of those teams are in the thick of it for the wild card, where the Yankees are only two back, and the Blue Jays and Orioles hold the top two spots. Neil, how did it come to this? Why is the AL East so good, and what should we be looking out for as we barrel down the stretch here?
So, yeah, the AL East has been a little bit interesting this year because you had one team that won it last year, Toronto, and looked like they were, you know, going into the season the best team, the best bet to kind of win it again. You also had Boston, who had had a couple of really down years, but they seemed to have the talent to kind of pull things together. They had a new front office, and they seemed like kind of a sleeping giant that had the potential to challenge. The team that really surprised a lot of people, especially stat heads, was Baltimore, who spent most of the first two-thirds of the season leading this division, and they were not really supposed to be great. They've had a history under Buck Showalter of playing better than people thought
they would.
This
year's Royals.
Well, yeah, because this, I'm confused about why stat heads didn't think the Orioles were going to be that good, because I think there's some stat I read a couple at the start of the season where over the last 5 years – they actually had the most combined wins of any American League team. So there's a consistency there. And is it just like a formula of they're Baltimore, they haven't won in a while, so they kind of get left out?
Well, I think in some of it has to do with the fact that they just went 81-81 a year ago. So they seemed like they had a really nice run where they won 93 games in 2012. That was the year that they the run differentials, the thing that stat heads look at, would have predicted them to win significantly fewer. So it was kind of viewed as maybe a fluky season. Then they won 85 games the next year, a respectable showing. They won 96 in 2014, which was also something that people didn't really see coming. Then when they went to 81-81 last year, I think the consensus of the numbers was that, well, they had their little run, and some of it was fueled by luck, and some of it is just their time is kind of done. They might be on the downside.
81-81 was a regression to the mean.
Right, exactly. It was literally a regression directly to the mean. That was probably the reason why. And the Sats underestimated the Orioles, but in the last month or so, things have kind of pulled more into line with what people expected
to see going into the season. And so you had Toronto pull ahead. You had Boston and Toronto become locked in this this battle for number one. And Toronto was leading it for, you know, late August for several weeks. And then they had a series with Boston this past weekend. And in conjunction with dropping a few other series and getting swept in one of them, they lost 2 out of 3 to the Red Sox. And so now, according to things like the 538 ELO model, which simulates out the rest of the season and tries to predict who will make the playoffs, the Blue Jays are actually about 20 to 25% likely to win the division, and the Red Sox are kind of taking control of this division at last, and that leaves Toronto, which still might have the most talent of any team in that division, as sort of almost destined, unless they make a push in the final 2 weeks of the season, for this one-game gauntlet of the wild card, which, as we all know, anything can happen.
You should say the Red Sox are only 2 games up.
Right, so the models...
They're not taking control of the division.
Well, so if you look at the playoff probabilities, though, the probability for the Blue Jays, if you look at a model like the one they use, the Baseball Gauge, which is another one of my favorite sites that kind of simulates out things and looks at the rest of the season, they would give Toronto only a 20% chance of winning the division. They would give them higher odds of making the playoffs, but that would almost strictly be through the wild card. And that was something that hinged on those head-to-head games in which they lost to the Red Sox. So these are systems that simulate out the rest of the season. They take into account schedule strength, and they take into account perceived quality of the teams. And so it's instead of, you know, we're kind of accustomed to looking at these differences in terms of, oh, how many games behind are you, all of these things. But things that go into that are also who are you playing, and certainly when we talk about the Mets, that's another consideration we've talked about. So schedule strength makes a big difference, I think, down the stretch of the season.
So Neil, dwell though on the Red Sox and the Jays just a second longer, because it seems to me like the Red Sox have really gotten their pitching in order after a season in which that was really the weakness in the team. The offense has been great all year long, but now they've got, is it Porcello or Porcello?
Porcello.
Porcello. Rick Porcello at 20-3. Granted, a 3.21 ERA.
We don't talk about wins.
I know, but
on
20
this podcast,
wins still,
Chad,
to me, is like a thing.
When you hit
baseball.
20 wins, you're allowed to talk about it.
Yes, exactly.
Until then, you just
exactly.
never mention
well,
wins.
Well, he does have a lot of wins above replacement also, which is good.
So, Drew Pomeranz has...
We didn't do that stat school yet, so how would we know?
We've done that
haven't
stat
Haven't we
school.
Done a stat school Kate, about wins above replacement?
But you didn't tell... Did you tell us...
Continuing ed course, Kate.
Did you tell us that we couldn't even reference wins? Or just that
I
we had
feel
to
like
know,
I must have mentioned that at some point.
We had to know better ones.
So, Drew Pomeranz has settled in nicely with the Sox after a rough start, after being traded from San Diego, I believe. And then David Price, their big offseason pickup, has really settled down in the second half. 2.16 ERA. Am I allowed to mention ERA? Would you prefer me to mention
FIP? You can
FIP?
Mention ERA.
It's what's on my sheet, so I'm mentioning ERA. And 0.82 whip over the last 7 starts. So, Neil, is that just a matter of regressing to their mean or to their natural talent? Which is that they got better as we expected them to be?
Yeah, I think so. In some of these cases, like Price, for instance, his fielding and appendant pitching, we talked about that, right, Kate? The metric that
okay. You're the one who signed my diploma.
Oh boy, we may have to we may have an academic scandal in our midst here. But anyway, this idea that pitchers really can only control walk, strikeouts, and home runs,
I remember
the three
now.
True outcomes.
I'm coming back.
It's flooding.
Joe, cue that song.
And so Price actually had been faring, you know, not as well as usual, but had still been doing all right in those categories, even when his ERA was bad. And so in some ways, he has kind of leveled out in this stat that we know to be fluky, ERA, the difference between your ERA and your FIP. And so his performance level probably hasn't changed all that much. It's just that his runs allowed have changed because of something that's largely beyond his control. But then also when you talk about...
Yeah. What is it like, Neil, to sort of have... What looks to the outside appear to be major changes and turnarounds in the world of sport actually not surprise you at all?
Well, I mean, it doesn't always work, Chad. You shouldn't overstate the value of these things.
Saying you can see through
A couple months ago, you were sitting around Nostradamus. Like, I can't wait for things to turn around for David Price.
Yes, yeah. I was can't wait talking to, about that
to rub
all
that in Chad
time,
and Kate's face.
All the time. I should also say that in the case of somebody like Mookie Betts, you have someone who was a good player last year and was, you know, very young player. He's still 23 this year, but now he has vaulted himself into that MVP candidate conversation. And I think that is as big a factor as anything. And then you have David Ortiz also just hitting the cover off the ball at age 40, having one of what has to be one of the best final seasons of a career ever if he ends up actually retiring after this kind of year. So I think a lot of things that the Red Sox had a rap for underperforming the past couple of years, and especially last year. And so in some ways they have kind of corrected that and regressed to the mean, and maybe and then some in some ways, where you have guys having seasons that are beyond what even the stats would have predicted for them.
So let's move on to the NL wild card. This is this is your moment.
I can
talk about the
here?
Mets. Absolutely. So the Mets are
in the wild card hunt.
Indeed, if the season ended today, one of my favorite phrases in all of sports, they would be the second wild card. They are a game and a half back of the Giants, a half game up on the Saints.
So they're in control.
Louis Cardinals. They control
yes,
their
of
own
course.
Destiny.
It's
another
that
great
same
sports
concept.
Cliche. So the Mets are the. In some ways, the one that has stormed back into this into the conversation. They were down to, I think it was 15% playoff odds when they were 500 in mid-August, and since then have sort of rattled off a pretty impressive stretch of games in which they've gone 17-9. Now they're 78% to make the playoffs. The thing is, the Giants have been just as bad amid all of that in some ways. Like, if you talk about change from the status quo, the Giants
have been just as bad as the Mets have been good.
Sorry, yes, thank you. Yeah. And they've fallen back. Like, we think of the Mets as the only one who there's been a lot of change for in the race, but actually the Giants have really fallen to earth in the second half. I think they're something like 10 or 15 games under 500, and they were hitting like 160.
Did you see
at some
that
point.
Coming when after their fast start? Because, like, their hitting has always been not super strong this year, and now their pitching rotation went from being amazing to struggling a little bit. But as you were looking at your numbers, you know, 3 months ago, where you just crack open a beer going, those San Francisco Giant fans are going to crash back down to earth.
They're in for a world of hurting. No, I don't think anyone really saw the tailspin that the Giants went into and kind of the converse of those low playoff odds that you mentioned for the Mets, Chad, was that the Giants were kind of just that high, you know, just that much in the opposite direction. And so it's been kind of a shocking decline for them. At one point, there was an 85% chance that the Giants would win the NL West. This was on July 10th. Which was their high point of the season. Now that number is all the way down to 15%. So it's kind of, you know, the probabilities describe what the stats think are going to happen in one number if you had to kind of pick one. And so, yeah, there was a chance that they would go into a tailspin like that. That's that 15% that, you know, was the difference between 85 and 100. But, yeah, it was pretty unlikely.
Okay, so the Mets likely to make the playoffs of these three teams, the Giants likely make these the playoffs of these three teams, and the Cardinals are likely to be the one odd man out, right?
Right, yeah.
But they all have the same ELO, which is interesting.
Yeah, in fact, our colleague Carl Bialik pointed that out to me this morning, the coincidence that all three would be rated exactly the same in this metric that we use to kind of rank teams. And for the Mets, you know, we talked about this also with the AL East race, but the Mets have an extraordinarily easy schedule over the remainder of the season. This game, this series that they're in right now against the Washington Nationals is represents the last team with a winning record right now that they would have to play over the rest of the season. So it, you know, scheduling matters. It's another example of it.
So, Kate, I know you had one question about
the Mets.
Baseball. Well, yeah.
I'm wondering if there's any parallels between the percentage chances of the Mets last year to turn it around and make the playoffs and what we've seen this year, because there seems to be a parallel.
You mean for the Mets?
For the Mets. I have a second follow-up.
This year's Mets, last year's Mets. That's
yes, I
saying.
Also had a follow-up to that. But yeah, if we looked at the graphs of playoff probability from last year to this year, would they match?
I think they'd be
probably pretty similar, although the Mets this year started their run a little bit later because the, you know, you mentioned the Cespedes acquisition that happened at the trade deadline. So the turnaround really started almost immediately in August and then kind of continued out throughout the rest, almost throughout the end of the regular season. Whereas now, the month of August was pretty unkind to the Mets in 2016, but once things kind of turned over to September, maybe in the last like week of August, they started kind of clicking again and winning ball games, and that coincided with, you know, the kind of stalling out of some of these other rivals and the disappearance of other ones, the outright kind of dropping out of the race for teams like the Marlins, who had surpassed the Mets in playoff odds at one point in midseason. And so, you know, when other teams drop out of the race, that's another kind of underappreciated component of improving your own odds because you have fewer teams to leapfrog.
All right, let's leave it there. And before we go and talk about tennis and close out our coverage of the U.S. Open, let's get one more word from our sponsor, a different sponsor this time. It's Stamps.com. These days, you can get practically everything on demand, including this podcast, which you can listen to whenever you want and when it's convenient for you. Anything you can do at the post office, you can do right now from your desk with Stamps.com. Buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package using your own computer and printer. Just today, my dad had to send me an emergency birth certificate that I need for a marriage license, and I felt bad making him schlep to the post office. If he had Stamps.com, which never closes, he could have just printed out a label and gotten postage whenever he needed it, 24/7, and I could have gotten my birth certificate without concern or a guilt trip. You can even get special postage discounts with Stamps.com that you can't find at that post office down the street. So right now, sign up for Stamps.com and use the promo code ESPN to get this special offer, a 4-week trial plus $110 bonus offer that includes postage and a digital scale. Don't wait. Go to Stamps.com, and before you do anything else, click on that microphone at the top of the homepage and type in ESPN. That's Stamps.com, and be sure to enter the promo code ESPN. Okay, now on to tennis. Our assistant liaison to Queens, Carl Bialik, is here. Hello, Carl.
I've gone from global to Queens, and I'm just fine with that.
Okay, because I got called a liaison, and I was upset.
Oh. Yeah, I didn't even focus on that part. Yeah, okay.
Again, I'm just trying to even things out. Yeah. Flatter hierarchy, guys. I'm just trying not to have so much
competition. No, it's because you want more power.
It's a zero-sum game, Chad.
Oh my
By the way, wouldn't he be an envoy to Queens instead of
the fanfic that is being written in your guys' head about the way that I run the show? You know, it's just, it's deplorable.
Should I come back later?
All right, let's talk about tennis, where Serena Williams lost, even though 538's ELO model gave her a majority chance to win when the tournament set out. She lost in a match to Karolina Pliskova when Williams had an 87% chance to beat Pliskova. Novak Djokovic lost, despite being a 50% favorite, to win when the tournament started, and an 88% favorite over Stan Wawrinka of
Explain
Switzerland.
Yourself.
Carl, what happened?
Explain yourself.
We really messed up. I'm so sorry.
That's what I want to hear.
We're never using ELO again. We did pretty well overall. And of course, it's going to be overshadowed because the two players who we gave a better chance than all the other players combined going into the tournament did not win the tournament. So that doesn't look great. But if you look match by match, round by round, player by player, if we gave someone about an 80% chance of winning, about 80% of the time that player won. About 90% of the time they won. Unfortunately, two of the ones we were wrong about were about the favorites.
Is it harder to do finals? You know, is there more variance in a final for whatever reason, fatigue throughout a tournament, that kind of thing?
It's a great question. I think we need to study that. My guess is there could be even less variance in the sense that we now have a lot of recent data about how these players have done on that court. So that's all informed their ratings at that point. Maybe we're not updating the ratings fast enough. So maybe we should have recognized that at that moment, Wawrinka was much closer to Djokovic than we thought going into the tournament. Fatigue is an interesting factor. Wawrinka actually had spent way more time on the court going into the final than Djokovic had.
They played more points, you mean?
Played more points because two of Djokovic's matches ended early. And one of them didn't happen at all because opponents were injured. And some people thought that could work for him, some work against him. We also don't really have a great way to account for recent injury, but maybe we could note that if a player withdrew from a recent tournament like Djokovic had in Cincinnati, that based on historical data, that somehow affects things. We got a lot of feedback from people who basically wanted us to just subtract a few percentage points based on things like that. And at 538, we try not to just ad hoc arbitrarily adjust a model because it doesn't look right. But we knew that this looked a little bullish on both of them. And the thing about predictions is we'll never know if we were wrong. Maybe he really did have an 88% chance going into that match, and this was the one out of eight times that he lost.
Well, when you look at, like, Serena, and I know you touched on the fact that you can't necessarily account for injury. It seemed like perhaps injury played some factor with Serena. Is there any way to incorporate into the model even age, or is it already incorporated in where you're like, okay, the older someone is, it just since we're all alive, we know there's probably more likelihood for wear and tear and fatigue and injury and certain things like that.
That's a great idea. I think one way you could look at it is to see if older players have more of these inexplicable losses. There's another school of thought that the more you've played, the more you know how to win, the more you sort of adjust your game and your approach to account for the injury. The funny thing about the Serena Williams loss is that there was evidence at the beginning of the tournament that she was suffering from an injury, but then she just rolled through her first four matches. So if we were looking at what is her form right now, we might have even given her a better chance. And then she said that she had a knee injury in that loss to Pliskova that had come up earlier in the tournament, but it wasn't really showing up in the results. So accounting for something like that in a model can be really tough.
And no matter what happened, Serena losing, and you wrote about this, would have been an upset no matter, you know, what kind of adjustments we make, unless we made like a crazy injury adjustment that no one could have known about. And one of the reasons why is just because she either wins tournaments or gets upset in horribly embarrassing losses, right? Because she's always such a huge
statistically
favorite.
Statistically speaking.
Embarrassing for us. I don't want to say she was embarrassed. It's an excellent
embarrassing in the sense of she had a very high likelihood of winning and failed to win.
Right. Yeah. And I think it's like with anything in life, if you are expected to do something, you don't get credit for doing it. If she had a 93% chance of winning a match and won it easily, you don't say, oh, well, she really made up those last 7 percentage points in great fashion. But then when you lose, everybody notices.
So she's like the kid that gets straight A's, and if they make like an A-, they get punished. But then some other kid would make C's, and then when they get a B, they get an ice cream dinner.
So it sounds like the way we always talk about Serena, and even the way we're still talking about her, is that she's the best female player playing right now, and yet she's now no longer the number one overall ranked player. I know that it comes down to she doesn't play as many tournaments, but does that suggest that there's a flaw with the way the WTA ranks players? Because she's not going to go into the next major, possibly, ranked number one overall.
This was a debate that came up a lot a few years ago, because at the time there were players who were ranked number one who had never won a slam, let alone in the past year. You had Dinara Safina, Caroline Wozniacki. Wozniacki, I think, has been ranked number one quite a bit longer than Venus Williams, who has 7 Grand Slam titles. Wozniacki has none. So at that time, it really came down to these were players who played a lot on tour. Serena Williams wasn't, and that felt really unfair. Kerber has won 2 of the last 4 majors. Serena Williams has won 1. So this is a case where it definitely helps Kerber that she plays more tournaments, but there's a lot less controversy this time because in this case, 2-1 kind of outweighs it. There was some talk if Kerber had lost her semi, she was still going to be number one, or if she'd lost the final. I think then you'd have more tension around it. Serena Williams could also get it back. If she plays the sort of Asian swing in the next few weeks and month, she could catch up to Kerber because she didn't play it last year, and so she has no points to defend.
So I want to talk about Kerber a bit and also about Wawrinka and how old they are, at least relative to the age that sort of these up-and-coming tennis players tend to be. Our colleague at 538, Ben Morris, wrote a piece this week about how the age of players who are winning their first 3 Grand Slam titles, that age is getting higher and higher. And Carl, I was wondering, you know, is that just because there has been such a dominant force on each side of the bracket for so long, the Big Four on the men's side and then Serena Williams on the women's side?
Definitely it's a factor. But on both sides, and especially on the women's side, because we're really just talking about Serena Williams, there's just not enough of Serena Williams to go around to account for that. So she would have to be beating all of them in each tournament for it to explain that. They're losing to players who are nowhere near as good as Serena Williams before even getting a chance. I mean, sometimes she's knocking them out, but she can only play 7 matches in a tournament. And she's often playing someone like Kerber, who's almost 29, or before she was playing Sharapova, who's really at an age that's near the end of a career if she comes back from this drug suspension. So I think there is a really strong top in both games and then a really weak next generation. And we see it in the men's game as well at this tournament. I mean, you just had a lot of young players who came in with a lot of promise, even played a few good matches. But something about the seven matches you need to win a slam, or even the three or four you need to make the second week, they just couldn't hang tough. And it was often their body that broke down. Dominic Thiem is a top 10 player, the youngest guy in the top 10. And he kind of fell apart against Del Potro. He couldn't finish the match. Lucas Pui had that amazing comeback and five-set win over Nadal. And then in the next match, he just wasn't himself anymore.
So this seems like a moment to talk about Djokovic breaking down as well. That seemed atypical for Djokovic. One of the hallmarks is that he can play these five-hour matches and be innovative even, you know, to the last set. Are we to blame that entirely on his toes bleeding and cracking and that gruesome picture that ESPN aired while it was happening? Or was there something else up that Wawrinka maybe, you know, had really did best Djokovic fair and square for, you know, that a couple sets there before Djokovic's feet bothered him?
Yeah, this is something where I think there's a lot we still don't know and might never know, because unfortunately what happens is they give their press conferences and then the loser, especially in this case Djokovic, goes away for a while, and the next time anyone asks, it'll have passed and maybe we'll never really find out. There's kind of this conspiracy theory that he was suffering from a lot of other things, but that those are things you couldn't get a timeout for, so that he said it was his toes, but there's no evidence for this.
Those toes were bleeding.
His toes were objectively bleeding.
I saw the blood on that side.
The umpire, it's up to the umpire, and the umpire is the one who has to grant the timeout. The physio comes and checks and has to grant it. This would need to be a conspiracy that Wawrinka was somehow in on, because he had conversations with people and later said that his main issue was just he didn't know what was going on, but once he was told, he was okay with it. So I think that, you know, Djokovic was within his rights to do that. But in terms of, you know, what does this say about him that he's breaking down? I think his fitness is somewhat overrated because of that five-set Australian Open that was like 6 hours and he outlasted Nadal. Sorry?
And he's gluten-free.
Yeah, he's
right?
been gluten-free for
point.
A while. And he was one of the first ones, so that's important.
That's what's holding me back from the ATP. Yeah. I just can't
He's really hydrated as well.
Yes. He is incredibly fit, no doubt. But there have been several cases where he was upset in a Grand Slam right after a very long, tough match. And Djokovic came into the tournament carrying some injuries, which were not exactly the ones that were bothering him in the final, but could just generally lead to a lack of match preparation and practice.
All right, Carl Bialik, 538s. What do we call you at the beginning of this?
Liaison.
Associate liaison to Queens. Thanks for stopping by.
My pleasure.
And now on to Significant Digit, when a telling number from the world of sports gets dropped on our lap from someone in the room. That someone today, almost as ever, is Neil Payne. Neil, before we hear the significant digit, I think we should play a hot take about the subject.
I can't imagine what that would be.
This is from Neil Payne on the Panic City podcast.
A lot of this is probably irrational because in the instructional league, he's not taking away a spot from someone. He's taking mental peace of mind away from me. So one thing is, we're on this great run. And you're telling me that I know that it has no bearing on the team on the field. I know this is superstitious. But instead of that being the story, you're going to go out and sign this guy, this clown that has not played baseball in college or in the minors, or since his junior year of high school, and he thinks that he can come in and immediately become a baseball player because he won the Heisman Trophy 10 years ago? It's nuts. He has a 0% chance of making the majors. He has a 0% chance of being a functional minor league player. He's garbage, and we're indulging his delusion. We're indulging this idea that he his ego, that he can come in and perform, and it's nuts.
Wow, Neil.
Neil, you didn't
How
even
do you
say
feel
his
right
name.
Now?
You know, I didn't need to
garbage.
Dignify.
He's garbage. We need to put that into the intro.
So, whoa, that's great.
Oh,
we should
auto-tune
note,
it.
Of course, auto-tune that Neil Payne is talking about Tim Tebow, the former pro NFL player.
Man,
who
led
pro baseball player.
Turned baseball player signed to a minor league contract.
Well, they paid him money.
Last week, the New York Mets signed Tim Tebow, setting Neil Payne into a frenzy.
I was very upset about that.
Note in there that Neil said that he has 0% chance of making the majors. Neil, I believe,
and 0% chance of like even being a functional minor league player
or a human being, according to Neil.
Well,
and then he said he's garbage.
So, Neil, my understanding is this significant digit is you running some numbers about the chance historically for a player to go from one sport to another to make the major leagues. Not Tim Tebow specific.
Right, so perhaps this could be viewed as a correction on my impassioned anti-Tebow rant, but the significant digit this week is 14.3%. That is the percentage of players who played in the NFL and also played pro baseball at any level that ended up making Major League Baseball. So the other numbers of interest are 20% made AAA or higher. That includes the majors because it's higher. 27% made AA or higher. 32% made high A or higher. And really, you know, it starts to fall off. Your 50% kind of break-even point is somewhere between low A and single A ball, where 50% of players that played in the NFL and tried their hand at pro baseball as well don't make it higher than that. So
Tim Tebow.
Oh, yeah. And I should say, I ran the numbers on sort of the particulars of those players, and their average age was between 23 and 24 years old when they were trying to do it. Tebow will turn 30 next year. So I would say his odds are low. Perhaps not zero, as I said. We never say something has a 0%.
Do you still think that he's quote-unquote garbage?
Well, he's not a baseball player. How could he possibly...
Nobody's anything until they try to be that thing.
Sure, but most people start to try... Right, but most people start to try before they're 30, and it's not part of a vanity project.
You are so down on midlife crises. What's your problem with the idea of a career reboot?
Yeah. Is it weird to be giving a hot take?
No, I mean, I don't think this is that hot. He is not baseball player.
It's just the part where you're like, he's garbage. Like, it wasn't like a rational, like, here are the percentage chances.
Well, I did say much, you know, I prefaced it by saying this may not be rational.
Right. That doesn't necessarily stop us from pulling people's hot takes.
That excuses everything that gets said after you make a qualifier.
I know this is irrational.
Just ask Hillary Clinton.
If you'd like to subscribe to Neil Payne's Hot Take podcast, it's called Panic City. You can find it on iTunes. All right, let's leave it there so that Neil doesn't have to get any redder in the face. Kate Fagan, thanks for liaising with us today.
Thanks for anointing me the liaison.
Neil Payne, always a pleasure.
I don't really have a title. I'm just fine with
Statman.
That.
Statman, you are a freaking superhero.
Oh, boy. I don't know if Statman is a superhero.
Why?
Because
superheroes
really
are irrational?
No, but
what are the odds of a superhero?
Because he doesn't have a superpower. He was just born with money like Batman.
Oh, no. I was just going to say
money.
The costume.
That's just the only.
Wow, hitting close to the stat to the core.
Was he
who
born know, with
who
money?
Knows what
I
Neil's background
no
is like?
Not really, but the Statman costume, I envision having a pocket protector as part of it. So I don't really know if that's like.
Given how you were raised, I'm sure it's a really expensive pocket protector.
Chad. But I was going to say, you know, Superman goes into the phone booth and he actually takes off the glasses, but I guess Statman, when he goes in the phone booth, he puts on the thick glasses.
Is this the longer sig dig than the Ichiro one that we did?
We
that
moved
one
on
time?
To the credits, so now we're in that space. I think the longest ever was the can millennials play basketball rant that Neil went on, where he disproved was it the Suns owner
Sarver.
Or something like that. Anyway, our podcast producer is Joe Sykes. Our podcast liaison is Jody Avergan. Production assistants from Tony Chow, Jorge Estrada, and Jonathan Yales. You can email us at podcasts@538.com. We would love to hear what you think. Find us on your favorite podcasting app and in iTunes at itunes.com/538 or on the ESPN app as well in the Listen tab. Be sure to review and rate the show when you find it in any of those great places. It helps others discover the program. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. Who has a new album out, that Mystery Mansion, that mysterious Mystery Mansion. I'm Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.